Good morning, I'm Jim Packard, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Very happy to have you along with us today. No matter what his doctors eventually tell John G. Roberts Jr. or the world about the diagnosis and outlook for his seizure disorder, it's clear that something changed irrevocably following the 52-year-old Chief Justice's momentary loss of consciousness on a vacation island dock on Monday afternoon. He lost his privacy and with it the aura of invincibility that came with youthful good looks and a spectacular career path. We're going to talk about epilepsy with Dr. Manoj Raghavan, who is an assistant professor of neurology and neurosurgery at the Medical College of Wisconsin. Dr. Raghavan is primarily focused on the evaluation and management of patients with epilepsy, a special interest in the surgical treatment of medically refractory epilepsy, and it's a pleasure to have Dr. Raghavan on the telephone with us today. Thank you, sir.
Good morning.
I'm glad to have you join the show.
Good to be here.
Epilepsy, a neurological condition, but what exactly is it?
As most people with a science background probably know, the brain is an electrical organ in the sense that the single cells or the units that make up the brain communicate with each other using electrical signals. In order for the brain to function normally, you need a fine balance between excitation in the brain and mechanisms that prevent this excitation from going out of control and setting off the whole brain into a cascade of brain cells firing away. In some instances, for a variety of reasons, you can have a failure of these mechanisms, and in those situations, what you end up with is a situation where occasionally the brain will go into this pattern of abnormal electrical excitation, leading to a neurological dysfunction or even positive symptoms such as convulsions. So that essentially is, what we refer to as an epileptic seizure.
Mm-hmm.
There are seizures, and I think it's important to distinguish between what are called epileptic seizures and other things that a layperson may refer to as a seizure, any kind of temporary, physical event may be referred to as a seizure.
Mm-hmm.
Some of these may have explanations that are outside of the brain. And sometimes a good number of patients may also have what are called psychogenic seizures, seizures that look like epileptic seizures but don't necessarily involve an electrical abnormality in the brain.
So I suppose the diagnosing what kind of a seizure has occurred can be very difficult.
It is. Unfortunately, most of the times we rely upon history to give us that diagnosis. History and certain diagnostic studies, such as brain imaging methodologies, such as MRI, or we have more sophisticated techniques for looking at the brain. And then, of course, looking at the electrical activity of the brain, recording brainwave activity, tests that are called EEG studies. Sometimes, you may have normal EEGs, normal MRI scans, but a history of events that occur sporadically. And sometimes it becomes important to bring the patient into a hospital setting where you actually are able to capture one of these spells using some kind of monitoring technique.
We're talking with Dr. Manoj Raghavan, who is assistant professor of neurology and neurosurgery at the Medical College of Wisconsin, and you practice at the Frederick Clinic, do you not?
Right.
What is your research in this field? What kind of things are you looking at personally?
I think one of the big problems with managing epilepsy is that there is a substantial percentage of patients, about 35%, with epilepsy that don't respond to medications. Medications are the first line of treatment. Somebody develops seizures, you put them on medications, about 50% of them will become seizure-free on that first drug.
50%?
About 50% of them. But if you fail to respond to that first drug, then you move on to a second drug and look for, to see if you can control the seizures that way. And you can move down a list of drugs or even combine drugs to try to attempt, to suppress seizures completely.
Yes, go ahead.
So in that process, what you find is that as you move down that list, the number of responders, that is the number of patients who eventually become seizure-free, having failed a certain number of drugs before, is a diminishingly small number, meaning that, the more drugs you have failed in the past, greater the likelihood that you will continue to fail further trials of medications. And that's essentially what defines drug-resistant epilepsy.
Mm-hmm.
And in that context, you know, there are these non-drug therapies that we explore, and there are, you know, a variety of them that are being researched and some of them that are available to patients, which primarily is the area of my focus, being a specialist in epilepsy.
We're talking with Dr. Manoj Raghavan, and if you'd like to join the conversation with your questions about epilepsy and seizures, in Madison, the number is 263-1890. Otherwise, it's toll-free at 800-642-1234. When we think about the case involving Chief Justice John Roberts, he had an episode 14 years earlier and then another episode. If someone presented themselves to you, what are your thoughts then as you begin to look at them?
I think the first question that would be, you know, raised by any seizure, a first seizure or even a second seizure, is were there provoking factors? And you can take a normal brain and under sufficient provocation, and that provocation could be in the form of severe trauma, could be a certain substance in the body which should not be there, for instance, cocaine, or certain other drugs, even certain prescription drugs, or certain chemical imbalances in your body. For instance, you dropped your, you know, the sodium level in your blood dropped for some reason because you have some problem with regulating levels of certain metabolites in your body. Mm-hmm. And you can have seizures from a variety of provocations to the brain. But that does not constitute epilepsy. You know, there is no intrinsic tendency for the brain to seize in those patients. So you have to have some kind of unprovoked event which tells us that there is some intrinsic capacity in the brain to produce these unprovoked events. And that, you know, if you have one spell, you may dismiss it. But if you have two or more spells, you certainly would go ahead and start treating it.
In the case of the Chief Justice, it was said that these were unprovoked, meaning that they weren't caused by a head injury or trauma or something like that.
Right.
So then where do you go next then once you determine that this is unprovoked?
Usually you would look for, you know, any kind of structural abnormalities in the brain, any growths, anything that could be provoking them as an intrinsic problem in the brain. You would also, you know, look at an EEG study to make sure that there is no electrical signature of the seizures, meaning when you have somebody with epilepsy, often when you do an EEG study, you would find some area of the brain that shows some evidence of electrical irritability, and that might signal to you that this person needs to be on medications long-term.
Medications can have troubling side effects,
sure.
Including drowsiness,
sure.
Insomnia, weight loss, weight gain, rashes, irritability, mental slowing, and forgetfulness. For involving the Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court, you probably would like to avoid mental slowing and forgetfulness.
Sure.
And so how do you begin to determine what drug to start with and where to err on the side of caution?
There is, you know, a fairly large choice of medications available to us now, especially in the last couple of, say, 15 years or so. We've had nine new drugs come out into the market. And one of the advantages with some of the newer drugs is that they have better side effect profiles. They don't necessarily have superior efficacy in controlling seizures compared to older drugs, but they have, in general, better side effect profiles. The question of side effects comes about when, you know, a person has epilepsy of a type that requires a lot of medication. The side effects of most of these medications are dose-dependent, meaning that you know, as you go to larger and larger doses, if you need larger doses to control a person's spells, the more likely that you're going to confront some side effects at that point. So in somebody who's had seizures, you know, after long intervals of time and, you know, not having frequent spells, it is possible that a very small dose of an antiepileptic may be all that the person needs in order to remain seizure-free. So at that point, you know, you would not be confronting any of the typical side effects that you may encounter at the larger doses.
Dr. Manoj Raghavan is an assistant professor of neurology and neurosurgery. at the Medical College of Wisconsin and practices at the Frederick and Medical College Clinics in Milwaukee. We're talking about seizures and epilepsy, and if you'd like to join in, we have a couple of lines open. In Madison, the number is 263-1890, otherwise toll-free at 800-642-1234. Let's take some calls, Doctor, and go to Tom in Plover first. Hi, Tom.
Hello. My son is, it's been about 2 years since his epilepsy was started, and he's been diagnosed with Lennox-Gastaut syndrome, so mm-hmm. he's very high functioning. Mm-hmm. We've gone through the medical or the prescription route, and he's on a bit of a cocktail right now. It doesn't keep him quite seizure-free, mm-hmm. but it's certainly better than where we've been. He's going to be starting the ketogenic diet mm-hmm. Shortly in the next month and a half. Mm-hmm. And, you know, any advice on helping, a nearly six-year-old on being able to go from, being able to eat an ice cream cone to, or a popsicle to transitioning to a very rigid diet and explaining those kinds of things to young children?
I think that's a very difficult, problem. And that's one of the reasons why, especially in adults, we seldom use the ketogenic diet.
And what is that diet?
A ketogenic diet is a diet that is essentially devoid of carbohydrates. You are trying to switch your metabolism to one that relies primarily upon proteins and fat to generate energy instead of carbohydrates.
Mm-hmm.
The brain, under normal circumstances, uses glucose, a carbohydrate, to generate energy, and it can switch that metabolism to utilizing, the breakdown products of proteins, which are the amino acids, and the fatty acids, which are the breakdown products of most fats, to generate energy. And in that metabolic change, one of the byproducts is these substances called ketones. We don't believe that it's the ketones themselves that have anti-epileptic properties. It has to do probably with the change in the metabolism itself. And for especially children with drug-resistant seizures, if they have failed several anti-epileptic agents and they are not candidates for alternative therapy such as epilepsy surgery, you would consider a ketogenic diet. The trouble with the diet is that sustainability of the diet, because you have to be on this diet which basically forbids any kind of carbohydrate intake for extended periods of time.
And explaining that to him, I suppose, it's
very difficult.
Very difficult in their ability to understand and respond to that.
Right.
Is that something that many of your patients end up on? Is that kind of a diet? Or
in our pediatric program, which is based at Children's Hospital right next door, the ketogenic diet is often used for drug-resistant seizures. In the adult population, which is what I mostly deal with, we seldom use the ketogenic diet. There are other diets, diets that people have heard about, such as the Atkins diet or the South Beach diet, which are to some degree ketogenic. There has been some preliminary studies. There was a study done by the NIH which indicates that the Atkins diet may have anti-epileptic properties, and there is a larger trial in process right now.
Hmm. Tom, thank you so much. Good luck to you with your son and his condition. We'll take more calls. Daryl and John will be coming up in just a moment as we continue talking with Dr. Manoj Raghavan, who is an assistant professor in Comprehensive Epilepsy Center in the Department of Neurology at the University of the Medical College of Wisconsin in Milwaukee. I'm Jim Packard, in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about seizures and epilepsy this morning with Dr. Manoj Raghavan of the Medical College of Wisconsin. And if you'd like to join the conversation, we have two lines open at the moment, 263-1890 in Madison, otherwise 1-800-642-1234. Dr. Raghavan, is a complete medical workup needed to find out whether or not the seizures that Chief Justice John Roberts reported, the two seizures, were really the only ones that have occurred, or Are some people just not aware that they're going through a seizure?
There are situations where a patient may not be aware of the seizures that they're having, especially in patients that don't that are not under observation at all times. For instance, the elderly, or in children who are experiencing events which go unnoticed by the by a witness, but then the person themselves has no recollection of the event.
Mm-hmm.
So, for instance, you may have a patient who's a single person, lives alone, has a seizure at night out of sleep, and unless there's some, telltale evidence of the seizure in terms of, say, a tongue bite or incontinence of urine or stool, there is nothing that might tell the patient that they had a seizure overnight, except the fact that they may feel a little sore and kind of fuzzy in the morning, cognitively impaired to some degree, or perhaps very tired. So there are patients who are, especially the ones that live alone or are not under observation at all times, who may have seizures that are unobserved. Even in patients who have seizures that occur at times when there is somebody around, there is a subset of patients with partial epilepsy. Epilepsy that comes from one region of the brain as opposed to involving the whole brain,
mm-hmm.
where you may have an event which does not necessarily impair you to a degree that you notice it. So so we call them subclinical seizures. You may observe them if you have a patient on an extended brainwave monitoring system, and you might see subclinical seizures on a record, which does have consequences for the brain, but is not apparent to the patient that they're having them.
There is a device that people can wear to monitor their blood pressure activity.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a device that people can wear to measure their brainwave activity?
Yes, there are ambulatory EEG recording systems where, you can hook up. Of course, you need electrodes to be planted on the scalp. Essentially, they're glued on for extended periods of time. And you can monitor people for several days at a stretch. The devices that are currently available, with the life of the battery and the amount of data that they can record for the capacity of data recording that they have, you can go up to several days with a device monitoring your brain waves.
Hmm.
If you need longer monitoring, we typically do it in the hospital. If you need to capture seizures in order to characterize what kind of seizures somebody is having, you might prefer to actually bring them into a hospital to an epilepsy monitoring unit and actually take down their medications to provoke one or two spells so that you can actually study them, determine where they come from or what kind of seizures they are.
Dr. Raghavan, our next caller is Daryl in Ionia. Hello, Daryl.
How you doing?
Very good.
I was just concerned about people, epileptics with driver's licenses. I have a cousin who's been an epileptic for probably 30 years, and every couple of years he drives his car into a building or smashes it into something, and then a little while later he'll get his license back. And I just can't believe it that these guys get driver's licenses. And even when I lived in West Dallas, on two different occasions, people went out of control, drove down the sidewalk and smashed into buildings. And it's like, isn't giving an epileptic a driver's license kind of like a crapshoot? You're playing with lives here.
Yeah, I think, the different states have different regulations about how long of a period a patient needs to be event-free in order to regain their driving privileges. So in Wisconsin, it's 3 months. There are states like New York, which is where it's much longer, or California, it's much longer. So there's a state-by-state regulation on that matter. What we typically advise patients is that, beyond what the law tells you to do, there is an element of personal risk and also risk to other individuals that the patient, is undertaking when they drive. A person may not have had a seizure for 3 months. Does not mean that in the fourth or fifth month that they can't have a seizure. And if the seizure happens at a time when they're driving, surely they could get into an accident.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the beyond state regulation, there is a element of personal responsibility that we try to explain to patients. Overall risk in terms of how many accidents on the road are due to seizures, it's a pretty small number, a very small fraction. There are more accidents caused by drunk drivers or people who are talking on the cell phone or, you know, eating while they're driving. So
then are felled by epilepsy.
Right.
Daryl, thank you very much for bringing up that point. We appreciate hearing from you. Anne, let's give you a chance in Presque Isle. Hello, Anne.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
I have a question, please. My son is 42. When he was 5, approximately 3 to 5, he was diagnosed with petit mal. And he was on medication till he was probably till he was about 13. Mm-hmm. Then he went off meds, and at age 25, and he had no symptoms then. Mm-hmm. At age 25, he had a grand mal seizure. I think it was prompted. He'd been partying, mm-hmm. drinking. It was very hot. We're up till 4 a.m.
Mm-hmm.
And now he's 42. He's had nothing since he was 25. He's not on meds anymore, obviously.
What?
What's the chance that he would have another seizure?
The seizure that occurred at the age of 25 that you mentioned appears to have, you know, all the features of what we would call a provoked seizure, where there was heavy alcohol consumption or a massive sleep deprivation or some other provoking factors. And this may be an individual who has some very subtle, you know, tendency towards seizures. And, you know, between patients who have no epilepsy or no seizures whatsoever and patients who have recurrent seizures with high frequency, there's a big spectrum of people who are just under the radar in terms of, you know, manifesting their symptoms. But under sufficient provocation, they could go into a seizure. So I don't know if anybody's, familiar with this event in Japan where they were playing this Yellow Monster video. And there was this slew of patients who showed up in emergency rooms with no known history of epilepsy in the past, but they'd all had seizures. And none of them, or most of them, probably never had seizures subsequent to that. So there are provocations that can lead to seizures, which does not necessarily imply that you have a recurrent epilepsy or you're going to have recurrent seizures. There are, for instance, alcoholics who can have alcohol-related seizures pretty often, and once they stop, you know, using the alcohol, they usually, you know, get better, unless they have some underlying seizure disorder that was being just aggravated by the alcohol.
Give me the difference between petit mal and grand mal.
These are more lay terms than terms that we use. For petit mal, typically in the lay sense, refers to a seizure where the patient does not actually fall to the floor and convulse.
Okay.
Whereas the ones where the patient actually convulses, people refer to as grand mal seizures. The word petit mal is used in the lay sense to refer to actually a mixed bag of seizures, which could include seizures of the kind that we call absence epilepsy, where a person just in the middle of doing something just pauses for several seconds and then just resumes what they're doing without any overt positive symptoms,
mm-hmm.
and they have no recollection of that little period of time that was just blanked out. Or it may refer to patients who have what we call complex partial seizures. These are seizures involving a certain region of the brain. It could be anywhere. It could be very often they are temporal lobe, which are the parts of your brain under your temples, or other regions of the brain, and these people have transient alteration of their awareness. They may have some impaired memory. They may display some odd behaviors. And the event may last about a minute or two, and then they kind of snap out of it or come to slowly over the course of a few minutes. So all of these are often referred to as petit mal seizures, but they represent very different types of epilepsy, and the treatment options are very different for these kinds of epilepsies.
Anne, thank you so much for your call. And let's go on to John in Eau Claire. John, what's on your mind today?
Hi, good morning. The doctor touched on this briefly. I'm trying to determine in your conversation why there's been little conversation about potential alcohol-related seizure in the judge. Could this be determined medically, or is it just a matter of honesty on his part?
I think, degree of alcohol use and is something that I'm sure was looked into, and it's hard to comment from without any knowledge of, whether even this is somebody that actually uses alcohol at all, to say much about whether that could have been a factor. But it's not just alcohol. There are several other things, for instance, antidepressant medications of certain kind or certain antibiotics. Many things can provoke seizures. And, I think taught to without a full history of what exactly, you know, were the conditions under which he had his spell, it's hard to say whether alcohol could have been a factor. Could have been a factor, sure.
What kind of a factor could stress be?
Stress per se is not a factor for producing seizures. Somebody with no known history of epilepsy or does not usually, you know, go into a seizure because of severe stress. Stress can be, or it does not cause epileptic seizures. Stress can be a factor in producing seizure-like events, which don't have electrical, you know, abnormalities in the brain, often referred to as psychogenic seizures. But in patients with epilepsy, often they will tell you that stressful situations are more likely to trigger those seizures.
Mm-hmm. So. John, thank you very much for your input. And on to Linda in Eau Claire. Hi, Linda.
Hi. I'm a volunteer caregiver for Quality of Life for a man that's 49 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And my question to you is that he takes currently right now a Depakote medication,
mm-hmm.
and he's been prescribed by a doctor to take 8 500 milligrams. Plus, he's on Dilantin, and he takes 6 100 milligrams. My understanding, and I know very little about the Wisconsin state statutes and the control of the Depakote, but it seems to be that there is a limitation on the amount that one person can be given, and I have to question the doctor because it seems like this exceeds the amount allowed by the Wisconsin state statutes.
It's not so much the total amount of the medication you take in. It's side effects of these medications have more to do with how much of it is there in your blood, or what we call the plasma level. And for these drugs, especially Depakote, Dilantin, it's important to closely follow those levels and optimize the medication so you're kind of hovering below the range at which you start getting side effects, but at the same time you're trying to maximize the efficacy of these drugs in terms of controlling seizures. So I'm pretty certain that, you know, his neurologist is following levels and trying to adjust doses based upon that. And clearly, if he's needing two drugs at pretty large doses, he has difficulty to treat epilepsy.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate your answer. Thank you.
Sure.
So much.
Linda, thank you very much, and good luck to you. We're talking with Dr. Manoj Raghavan, who is a assistant professor in the Comprehensive Epilepsy Center in the Department of Neurology at the Medical College of Wisconsin, and practices at the Neuroscience Center at Frederick and Medical College Clinics. As you mentioned or alluded to, most of your clinical practice involves adults.
Right.
And at what point does the chances of having an incidence of epilepsy begin to diminish? Is there a certain point or certain age that can be reached?
Actually, if you look at the occurrence of new onset of seizures across the age groups, in childhood, there is a pretty high incidence of new epilepsies that you see. And as you get older, you come into your teens, there is a drop-off, and in your midlife, you have a relatively low frequency. When I say low frequency, something of the order of 20, 25 cases for every 100,000 patients or 100,000 individuals. But then as you move up into the age group above 60, again, this curve turns up and you start seeing increased incidence of new onset of epilepsy. And the causes are very different. For instance, in the pediatric age group, it has more to do with, for instance, birth abnormalities in the brain that come to light after a few months, or it could have to do with problems during childbirth or certain genetic syndromes. Whereas in the elderly, above 60 years, the causes are very different, more to do with, say, strokes or tumors or degenerative problems in the brain, such as Alzheimer's disease. So a variety of age-related problems in the brain increase the incidence of seizures as you get older. In fact, the numbers go up quite drastically, much more than what you see in the pediatric group once you get up to about 70, 80 years.
When you diagnose as necessary to have some surgery,
What kind of surgery are you able to perform to be able to provide some relief or to be able to halt or arrest this development of seizures?
So surgery is an option. And before I talk about surgery, you know, we classify seizures broadly into two main categories. One, where the seizure comes from a region of the brain which has an electrical dysfunction, which periodically goes into this abnormal firing pattern.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, it may start in one region, but then it could spread, involve a wider region of the brain, or even involve the whole brain to produce a convulsion, a full-blown convulsion. Or it may be just an event that is restricted to one region of the brain, producing what we call a partial seizure. On the other hand, there is another kind of epilepsy, or another broad category of epilepsies, where the seizures don't start anywhere in particular. We call them generalized epilepsies. Often they have a genetic basis, and the kind that is not localized to any particular region of the brain, surgical treatment is not an option for those patients.
Right.
At least the conventional epilepsy surgery, which involves taking out brain tissue, is not an option for those patients.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, if you have partial epilepsy where a region of the brain has been identified as the source of your seizures, and if you can demonstrate or if you can prove that there is no critical functions located there, such as language or memory or any of those functions which would leave you severely neurologically impaired, then as you would with a tumor, you would go in and take it out. A lot of what we do in terms of evaluating patients for epilepsy surgery has to do with answering those two questions. Where do the seizures come from? What is located next to it? You know, how safe is it to remove it? And if you can answer those questions to your satisfaction, you can probably do epilepsy surgery in a lot of patients, even if they don't have any kind of clear lesions present.
Understood. Ray and Kashina, let's give you a chance. Go ahead.
Hi. Hi, Doctor.
Yeah.
My grandson has epilepsy, I think. He has a lot of seizures and that, and they use a lot of medicines. Now, one of them I know is phenobarbital.
Mm-hmm.
Then they switch it to something else, and then they switch it to something else, and they keep going back and forth with these medicines. Will he ever get to the point where, I mean, he's been on this now for 17 years. Is he ever going to be get on just one medicine instead of all these different ones? Immune to certain medicines, and then they get unimmune again to the same medicine a couple of years later? What's the scoop on that?
I think the fact that they have had to try several drugs probably places him in a category of patients that are unlikely to get their seizures entirely controlled with medications alone. But remember, he is 17, and his brain is still changing. And as it comes into adulthood, there are many organizational changes that could modify his seizures or modify his epilepsy. At this point, without knowing what kind of epilepsy he has, whether he has a generalized epilepsy or whether he has a partial epilepsy, it's hard to say, what to expect down the road. But your question about do you get immune to medications, and there are situations where we encounter that, where you start somebody off on a medication and they seem to respond very well. And then after a few months, they stop responding or they start having breakthrough seizures. Often we refer to them as honeymoon periods with a medication, but we don't fully understand that. It doesn't happen with all medications. In fact, most of these drugs are chosen on the basis of the fact that they produce sustained efficacy rather than transient or short periods of response. These are drugs that the brain usually does not habituate to by conventionally known mechanisms.
In the case of Ray's grandson, are there new medications coming into widespread use?
While there are, more medications in the pipeline that will probably become available down the road, at least two very big studies, one done in the 80s with a slightly older group of medications, and one that was done in the VA system in the United States. Another large study done in Scotland, done after some of these newer medications came out, both come to the same conclusion about response to medications. The first drug has about a 50% chance of success in controlling your spells. Second drug has, you might render maybe another 13 or 14% seizure-free. And as you walk down that list of drug failures, you failed first, second, third, fourth drug, you are learning at that point not something necessarily about whether a drug is, you know, appropriate for this person's epilepsy. You're learning more about the nature of the epilepsy itself, that it's a drug-resistant kind of epilepsy.
Mm-hmm.
You can think about it in a different way. If you have, you know, as I said earlier, any part of the brain can be triggered into a seizure by exciting it. I can electrically stimulate a part of the brain and send it into a seizure. But in patients with epilepsy, especially the partial epilepsies, you have a part of the brain which has this increased excitability relative to the surrounding, you know, normal brain. And what you're trying to do by giving medications is trying to keep this area quiet, trying to prevent it from going into these abnormal firing patterns. Now, the amount of medications that you need for that varies quite a lot across patients, depending upon how excitable this region is.
Mm-hmm.
If it's a very excitable tissue, you may need a lot of medications, which may be intolerable for the rest of your brain. And that, in a sense, defines, you know, drug resistance, you know, needing more medication than what the rest of your brain can tolerate is, you know, a criteria for drug resistance.
Dr. Manoj Raghavan is an assistant professor of neurology and neurosurgery at the Medical College of Wisconsin. We're talking today about epilepsy and seizures, and we will continue to take your calls in just a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jim Packard sitting in for Kathleen Dunn. Happy to have you along with us today for another core hour as we talk with Dr. Manoj Raghavan of Milwaukee. And if you'd like to join this conversation, we do have a couple of lines open. In Madison, the number 263-1890. Otherwise, toll free at 800-642-1234. Do you ever see a link, doctor, between epileptic seizures and migraine headaches?
Yes, there is a considerable overlap. Patients with epilepsy tend to have a higher frequency of migraines. And it probably, migraine has some, you know, at the basis of migraine has some things to do with excitability in the brain, and especially in regions towards the back of the head.
Mm-hmm.
And it may represent some shared mechanisms of the two disorders, which we fully don't understand the molecular basis of. But there is an increased incidence of migraine in patients with epilepsy.
Let's go to Joan in Decorah, Iowa next. Joan, what's on your mind today?
My daughter is 40 years old now, and she's been called autistic. And she's never had a seizure where she loses consciousness, a grand mal seizure.
Mm-hmm.
But she has episodes of aggression, and one doctor has said that he thought she was having temporal lobe seizures, and I wondered if the doctor had thinks that this is a possibility, and if there's medication for aggression that is more effective than you know, not having medicine.
Sure. Behavioral changes can follow seizures, especially right after a seizure. You may have a patient that, especially with a partial seizures of temporal lobe origin, you can have combative behavior. You can have, you know, agitated confusion. And also it can occur as part of as a psychosis that you can see in some patients with temporal lobe epilepsy that follows a cluster of seizures, for instance. So you may have a seizure or a prolonged seizure or a bunch of seizures on one day, and then, you know, you may seem to come back to normal after a couple of days. You start manifesting some symptoms of bizarre thinking or hallucinations or paranoid feelings. These are all features that we typically, you know, call a psychosis. So these are seizure-related psychosis, which can lead to behavior problems. Or right after a seizure, you may have combative behavior. So I think that the fact that such things do happen is probably the basis of, you know, why the doctor felt it that may be what's going on. But it's hard to prove unless you actually are able to document the presence of epileptic seizures going on before or during one of these spells. So if the spells are frequent enough, you can try to capture one of them and see if there's a correlation between the behavior and what's happened electrically in the brain just before or during the spell. But without that correlation, if the events are infrequent and you feel unlikely to capture one of those spells, sometimes if the suspicion is high, you may try treating the symptoms with an anti-epileptic drug to see if you see a response. So either based upon response to an anti-epileptic drug or by actually demonstrating it. That those would be the way to actually confirm or disconfirm that notion.
She is on a medication called Trileptal.
Mm-hmm.
But I understood it was for explosive behavior because she's never actually, you know, we've never ever seen a seizure.
Mm-hmm.
And there's another medicine called Topamax, I
mm-hmm.
think.
Yeah.
Have you seen these used for aggression?
Both of these drugs are primarily anti-epileptic drugs, anti-seizure drugs. And many of the anti-epileptic drugs also find a second use for mood control or behavior control. And practically almost all of the anti-epileptic drugs out there have been used at some point or the other as by psychiatrists for behavior modification. And they're quite effective or at least several of them are quite effective in that regard.
Joan, good luck to you. Thank you very much for your call, and we hope things go well. Jennifer in Hazelhurst, let's give you a chance. Hello.
Hi. I called in just because we're part of a research study for epilepsy. My husband has complex partial seizures,
mm-hmm.
and we've gone through everything, and we even went up through the testing for the surgery,
mm-hmm.
and we were put in a research study at Marshfield Clinic, and I just want people to know that there is hope for people, because I have seen my husband have a reduction of by 50% of his seizures that he has due to this new stimulator that Marshfield Clinic and I think Mayo is also part of,
mm-hmm.
And it's been a very good thing, and it is the cutting edge of epilepsy. And I'm witnessing it firsthand.
You're probably referring to the deep brain stimulator?
Right. He had it inserted. We've had it in for a year, and he's had luck with it. He was one of the first 50 in the United States to get it.
Mm-hmm.
And we're reporting how many seizures he has, and we have seen a 50% reduction. It's not perfect,
sure.
but it is the future of epilepsy.
Yeah, there is a very strong interest in electrical means to control the behavior of the brain to prevent it from going into seizures. And one of those efforts is the deep brain stimulator. And essentially, it's a device that delivers a planned program of electrical stimulation to a deep location in the brain that can potentially exert an effect across the whole brain. One of the limitations of conventional epilepsy surgery is that you need to be able to take out tissue in order to, you know, control seizures. Sometimes it's not possible because you have seizure-producing areas that overlap with important functions such as speech or language, and in those cases, you might choose not to undergo epilepsy surgery, or it may not be feasible to do some surgical treatment. In all of those patients, or you know, the other situation is where your seizures come from multiple locations in your brain, and it's hard to pick out different areas of the brain and without causing severe neurological deficits.
Mm-hmm.
So, in all of those patients who are not candidates for, you know, ideal candidates for conventional epilepsy surgery, people have been interested in other ways to modify the electrical behavior of the brain aside from medications. One of the therapies that already exists and has been approved for that purpose is something called vagus nerve stimulation, where you have a pacemaker-like device that is sending a train of stimulation, electrical pulses, to a nerve in the neck called the vagus nerve. And for a lot of patients, that can be that can significantly reduce seizures and decrease the amount of medications they need. It's not a cure. It does not get rid of the fundamental problem in the brain that's causing the seizures, but it can modify the incidence or frequency of seizures and their severity.
Sounds remarkable.
The other device that the caller was just talking about is something that's still experimental. It's still being studied. It's something called deep brain stimulation. And different targets in the brain have been considered as potential areas where you could modify seizure behavior by stimulating. So this is one of the studies. There's a similar study going on in Europe. Another kind of device being looked at right now is something called responsive neurostimulation, where there is a device which monitors electrical activity from areas that are producing the brain constantly, and every time it detects the onset of a seizure, which it can be taught to, it sends out a train of electrical stimuli that tries to abort the seizure electrically. So that's, again, is something that's in the works, and over the next few years, we may have alternative therapies to conventional surgery.
Jennifer, thank you very much for your call. I understand that there are about 2.7 million people in the United States that have epilepsy. Mm-hmm. Is that a figure that is consistent with what you understand?
Yes. I mean, the estimate has ranged from anywhere from 1% to 2%. And if you go to, you know, developing countries or countries in the tropics, where there are other conditions that may predispose you to seizures, such as, for instance, parasites, such as tapeworm infestations with parasites landing up in your brain causing seizures, or malaria. Cerebral malaria is often a big cause of seizures, especially in Africa. Tuberculosis with lesions that are present in the brain can often be common cause of seizures. So when you go to other countries, the causes and the incidence of epilepsy may be different, but in the United States, it's about somewhere between 1% and 2%
of the population.
Estimate. Yes.
Bob in Darlington, let's give you an opportunity. Go ahead.
Okay, good morning to you and to your wonderful guest.
Mm-hmm.
In the early 1960s, I did some research on Parkinson's disease.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think in the latter 60s, I think clinicians started using that drug to treat Parkinson's.
Mm-hmm.
But it proved to be somewhat beneficial, but yet it was quite toxic.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just wondering if you in your field now with the epilepsy and seizures, if there's coming on board a lot of combined drugs,
mm-hmm.
And how they work.
I think,
and why it's being done, really.
Done in what sense?
Well, in the sense of just taking one particular drug entity rather than combining maybe
different drugs. Yeah.
Different drugs, which I know is done now. And in fact, they do that with Parkinson's now.
Sure.
And I think it works a little better than just the L-DOPA.
Mm-hmm.
I think, isn't that right? I think so.
Yeah, people do use different combinations of therapies now for Parkinson's as well. And with epilepsy, the logic for combining drugs is that, typically we like to use a single drug, what we call monotherapy. Monotherapy usually carries the lowest risk of side effects. You don't have the combined side effects of two medications. Because medications not only, they may interact, for instance, the way they are metabolized by your liver, and a lot of these drugs are metabolized by your liver, and they may have interactions in the liver. They may interact in the blood, where they displace each other from binding to proteins in your blood and alter the levels of each other. And finally, they may interact with each other in the brain, where they exert different kinds of effects on the brain, and the combined effect of two drugs is not necessarily the sum of the two effects. So the reason for combining drugs is that, firstly, you don't get adequate response to single drug treatment. You find that a patient is continuing to have seizures despite adequate trials of monotherapy with one or two or even three separate drugs tried as a single agent. At that point, you may want to try to combine them. When you combine drugs, you try to use drugs that have very little interaction either in the liver or even in the brain. It's hard to guarantee that because typically drugs are not studied in combinations, especially if combinations are more than two. In a lot of the drug trials that are used to kind of get efficacy or measures for new drugs that are coming into the market, patients are always... you add on the new drug to something that's already there. So there is some data on, say, two drug therapies based upon those trials. But when you go to combinations of more than three or four drugs, it's very hard to predict how patients respond. People prefer to stay away from big combinations of medications. But the main logic is basically that by combining two drugs that have very different mechanisms of action against seizures, you might get a greater benefit in terms of seizure control.
Bob, thank you so much for your call. And on to Norbert in Green Bay for the last word. Hello, Norbert.
Hello. Thank you very much for taking my call. I'll try to be quick here. Last fall of 06, I had two episodes where I'd wake up in the morning and I would not have short-term memory, and I would not make memory during that period.
Mm-hmm.
Then in December, my wife followed me on the floor, passed out. And since then, we've done MRIs, CT scans, ambulatory EEG, and a regular EEG, a sleep-deprived EEG, and they found that my brain activity was normal,
mm-hmm.
put me on Trileptal, and then in June of this year, we went off Trileptal, and since then, I've had a seizure in June when I was on one pill of mm-hmm. Trileptal, and then another one in just a week ago
mm-hmm.
when I was on completely weaned, and then did another sleep-deprived EEG this week and said it was completely normal.
Mm-hmm.
Now, complicated issue here is that I have sleep apnea. My question is, could these memory losses be a form of epilepsy? All the doctors, in fact, have ended up...
I've got to stop and let the doctor respond in about 30 seconds.
I think the kind of case you're describing is, the more complex situation where it's not easy to establish a diagnosis of epilepsy, especially if you can't capture one of those spells. And sometimes you have to rely upon a response to an anti-epileptic agent. The response to Trileptal may be indicative of the fact that this is possibly an epileptic disorder. So sometimes you have to wait for it to play out in order to establish the diagnosis.
Good luck to you, Norbert. I wish we had more time, but we have exhausted it. Dr. Raghavan, thank you so much for spending this hour with us. It's been very enlightening.
Thank you. It was good to be here.
Dr. Manoj Raghavan is an assistant professor of neurology and neurosurgery at the Medical College of Wisconsin in Milwaukee. Our thanks to Carmen Jackson for on-air phone production today. I'm Jim Packard. Stay tuned because Larry Mueller will be coming up on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.